Welcome to VHA Weekly Update number 9. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. Thank you to those members who provided feedback on the draft Easter public holidays matrix. That feedback was incredibly useful in terms of settling the matrix, which has now been distributed to members. With respect to bargaining for doctors, that is doctors in training and specialists, that has commenced with the AMA and the parties are now meeting on a weekly basis. With respect to medical scientists, that agreement is still in the process of being drafted and we should have further updates shortly. With respect to allied health professionals, members may recall that that agreement was lodged with the Fair Work Commission just prior to Christmas. We've followed up with the Fair Work Commission just to get a sense of its progress, and we've been advised that there were a large number of agreements that were lodged just prior to Christmas, and we anticipate that it will be at least 2 weeks away before it is listed for hearing. Members, though, will find the implementation guide presently up on our website. We are still in the process of finalising a salary circular that deals with the issue of dates of implementation for structural changes under that agreement. The mental health agreement has been filed with the Fair Work Commission and we are also awaiting a hearing date for that. With respect to the community app, thank you to those members that have signed up. And just a reminder that when you do sign up to select the subjects that you want to receive information on, that will ensure that you receive the subjects that you're interested in as opposed to being bombarded with information more generally. With respect to our WorkCover services, members should be aware that we have two workshops coming up, one in March and one in April. The first of those workshops is on the 24th of March and it's Welcome to the WorkCover System. The second workshop is on the 28th of April, WorkCover Return to Work Obligations, and members can book for those workshops now. With respect to community health, and the Social and Community Services Agreement first, we understand that the ASU is consulting with its members further to the response from VHAA, which reflected a proportion of community health members. We have written to the allied health professionals requesting a meeting in late March to start to talk about the logs of claim that they have served on three of our members. Those logs of claim have been consolidated into a single document and will be made available to members through the community app shortly. And finally, I should say something quickly about the Fair Work Commission decision with respect to penalty rates. People in public health services and standalone community health centres will not be affected by that decision. That decision applies to a small number of awards. Enterprise agreements set the rates for penalties in the public health system and standalone community health system. It is our view that the principles that underpin that particular decision are not transferable to the health sector. They are different considerations. We had previously made that clear by writing to the unions in February 2015 to state that we would not be seeking to make claims to reduce penalty rates during the bargaining round. Most unions have made that clear to their members that there is no impact of that decision, but just in case some members, some employees do mistake the impact of that decision, they should be aware that there is no impact on penalty rates for the health sector. That concludes this week's weekly update. Welcome to the VHA weekly update discussion, where we discuss a particular topic in greater depth. Joining me this week is Principal Industrial Relations Consultant Tim Nagel. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Stuart. Good to be here again.
Now, as we do each week, we have our box of mystery under which there is a clue as to this week's subject. Would you be good enough to do the honours? So for those people who might be listening on the podcast, would you be good enough to describe what you see there?
I see a tea towel.
Tim, you couldn't be more wrong. The object is, in fact, underneath the tea towel. So if we reveal the tea towel, would you be good enough to describe the objects that you see underneath?
I see a CD from Trout Mask Replica and also a book, a James Joyce Finnegan's Wake.
Excellent choice, Tim. I can tell that you're not familiar with Captain Beefheart and his magic band and their 1969 classic Trout Mask Replica. It's a CD of avant-garde jazz. It's incredibly organised and structured, but it's a bit difficult to listen to. James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake is a very difficult book to read, and if you make it past page 50 without falling into some sort of coma, you're doing an excellent job. For some reason, these objects reminded me of today's subject for discussion, the Mental Health Agreement.
Yes.
So the Mental Health Agreement has recently been put to a ballot to employees.
It has, and it's been declared, so we're very lucky to have had the ballot approved by employees, about a third participation rate, which was good, and a 99.2% approval rate, which was great.
And presumably the other 0.8% simply forgot to fill it in?
No, it is.
And in terms of that participation rate and the vote, that means that a valid majority have approved that agreement, and under the Fair Work Act, that means that the agreement has now been made. What's the next step?
So within 14 days, we have to make an application to the Fair Work Commission to approve the agreement. So there's an application process where we need to address a number of key items. For instance, the Bureau of Overall Test and also the classification comparison between the modern award and the pre-modern awards. So that takes a bit of time to do that sort of.
Not to forget our favourite bit, the NERRR.
The NERRR, that's right.
And has that been lodged with the Fair Work Commission?
It has. So we've lodged that last Friday. So that's in the process, the Fair Work Commission approval process. So that can take anywhere between 2 to 6 weeks to go through that process.
So it's assessed at the Commission, then it's set for a hearing date, and then it comes into operation 7 days after it's approved by the Fair Work Commission.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes.
And who is going to be covered by the new mental health agreement?
So so the employers that will be covered, it's the same employers as last time, with the exception of North East Wangaratta and also Beechworth. They won't be on the respondents list this time. Because their mental health services have been transferred over to Albury Wodonga. In terms of employees, it's the same group of employees, those solely or predominantly employed in the provision of mental health services.
I think that's a point worth emphasising, that the test with regards to which employees are covered by the new mental health agreement is unchanged from the previous mental health agreement, that's solely or predominantly engaged in mental health.
That's right.
But we've had a reduction in the number of employers reduced from 19 to 17.
That's right, yes.
And in terms of the length of the agreement?
So it's a four-year agreement and it has an expiry date of the 30th of June 2020.
Okay, that's that matches in with other agreements?
Yeah, roughly. I mean, the last agreement sort of expired on the 31st of March, so this one expires on the 30th of June, which is just a representative of the additional time it took to wrap up the agreement.
So during this round of enterprise agreements, we've sought to make a range of changes with regards to how agreements look and how they're structured. I think it's fair to say in the case of the mental health agreement and the connection perhaps to Finnegan's Wake that there's a lot of work to be done in terms of making that a more accessible, transparent document, but some of that work has effectively commenced. What are some of the changes that have occurred this time around?
Yeah, so the agreement does look different. We've done a lot of work with both of the unions on making the document more user-friendly. So like the other agreements, we've tried to update the language and the structure of clauses. We've had a lot of success establishing not common clauses in terms of exactly the same, but having more familiarity with the clauses that will be included in the agreements, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, I'm sure. And we've also taken the time to improve the logical order of the clauses within the agreement, so putting the leave clauses together as much as possible, for instance, the parental leave clauses, that sort of thing. We've also spent a lot of time with the assistance of the department incorporating the NES, making sure that as far as practicable there's one document for people to look at and not two. It becomes quite difficult for employers where they have to look at a number of sources just to try and realise what the entitlements are for employees, so we've collated that into the one document. We've also cross-referenced related clauses where possible, so that if there is another clause that impacts upon the clause that you're focused on, that's brought to your attention. And also, as I said before, we've tried to incorporate common clauses as much as possible across the agreements.
And just before we get to the common clauses, I recall that the last mental health agreement had a provision in there saying that the parties were going to work together to modernise that agreement. That clause has been rolled over, in effect, to the new agreement, that's correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we did a lot of work in the last round, the last EBA round, to try and modernise the agreement. It didn't come to passing fully, but we took a lot of learnings out of that. So this time the parties have decided to keep that clause and do a little bit more work during this period of the agreement to try and make the agreement even better still next time.
I think it would be useful if we set out with the objective of using this time from now really until the next agreement to get as much of that work done as possible so that we can make that as contemporary a document as possible in close consultation with the unions, who certainly with some of the other agreements have had a big contribution to make to improving those documents also.
Well, I mean, it's partly their document as well, so they've got interest in making it as good as it can be.
I think it's in a mutual interest to ensure that our respective members can interpret and understand and find the right entitlements.
Yeah, I agree.
And in terms of the way that the document is set out more broadly?
So it has five sections. The first section deals with common clauses, so that's common provisions that go across all of the disciplines within the agreement. The second section relates to nurses and also the PSOs as well. Section 3 deals with health professionals. Section 4 deals with the health and allied services staff, and Section 5 deals with the management administrative officers. In the last agreement, it had a similar structure, but looking at the title page or the contents, it was difficult to see where each group started and stopped, particularly for the health and allied and the management and administrative officers. They often had combined clauses, which made it difficult to interpret. So we've made the sections really clear. The consumer consultants, carer consultants and also peer workers have also been distinctly put into the health and allied services section. And that was one of those things that created a bit of confusion in the last agreement, but what entitlements actually apply to those staff. So we've cleaned all that up and made it very well structured in terms of people being able to identify what entitlements apply to them.
You made some reference earlier to common clauses within this agreement and across agreements. Could you just remind those people who are watching and listening what the common clauses involve?
Yeah, so the common clauses focused on those procedural clauses that really have the same effect for all employees. So these are discipline clause, dispute resolution clause, consultation and also dispute resolution. So we've tried to keep those common clauses for the mental health agreement.
I think it's fair to say that the end result is not quite identical, that there are some points of variance, and it's interesting to reflect on, particularly when we've had those reports from Dr. Travis and from Dr. Duckett about the fact that we have that there is a greater need for consistency. And it's interesting to reflect to the extent that the industrial relations culture that we have within health impacts on the lack of consistency and not supporting health services in terms of taking a consistent approach across their industrial relations obligations.
Mm. And we know that it was very important for our members to have those consistent clauses. It is difficult for practitioners when managing big workforces, which a lot of our employees have, managing those differences between different procedural elements of the agreement. So by having a single process, you can apply that more consistently, more predictably for groups of staff. I mean, we've had a lot of success. I mean, in terms of those common clauses, we know that the dispute resolution clause, for instance, the redundancy and associated entitlements, and also the disciplinary clause are the same. We've still got a little bit to go on the consultation clause, but that's work in progress at the moment.
So just in terms of the consultation clause, where there are a couple of points of difference, just to highlight those for those who are listening.
So there's two significant differences in that clause. The first one relates to the indicative timeframes around the process. So as people would know by now, a lot of focus was given during the last EBA round about providing a predictable process for consultation. We had both sides saying frustrated by the process for different reasons. And part of that dispute, part of the disputes that arose from that clause were process, which is probably the last thing you should be arguing about, but it tended to be the most frequent thing. So we were very keen, and the unions and everyone else were very keen to put in a process around that. And we thought to make that meaningful, we needed indicative timeframes because that helps both sides. Unfortunately, we didn't quite land on that for this agreement. But we would say that any change should use indicative timeframes anyway when they map out when they think the changes should happen, when the steps in the process should happen.
So if somebody's developing a change impact statement, what we would recommend is that that change impact statement should include indicative timeframes for the steps under the agreement. And if there is some major impact on those indicative timeframes, that might be a good basis on which employers consider utilising the Fair Work Commission.
And that's right. We talked about that in one of our previous podcasts about using that trigger as something that you would consider notifying to the Commission about some frustration in the change process.
I think with regards to the common clauses generally, but particularly with regards to consultation, getting feedback from members as to how effective or otherwise those provisions are will be incredibly important.
The other major change in the major difference in the consultation clause is the other consultation provisions in the other agreements use a two-step process. So there needs to be a major change and then a significant effect. That remains in this agreement, but there is a separate requirement where there is not necessarily a major change, but a significant effect that employees need to go through a consultation process.
That said, I think the circumstances where there is a significant effect without a major change, those two are usually inextricably linked. And for me, it's unlikely that there'd be many circumstances where you could have a significant effect without the major change.
Yeah, and that's true. And what we've done in the agreement is, I mean, the unions were very clear in that they thought that there should be a conversation, there should be a discussion between the parties where there is a significant effect. So this isn't about going through the whole consultation process prescribed in the agreement. This is about a process whereby there's a conversation between the parties.
So just to emphasise that, if there is no major change but a significant effect, consultation is required, but you were not required to go through the steps that are set out in the consultation clause.
That's right, yes.
Tim, as with any new agreement, there are, of course, wage increases, and it's always a subject of intense interest. Could you summarise the wage increases under the new mental health agreement?
Yeah, so under the new agreement, there's back payments to the 1st of October 2016, or the full first pay period on or after that.
That is the FFPPOOA.
That's correct. And the CPD, the Continuing Professional Development Allowance, is also, however titled, is rolled into those increases.
It's interesting. That's really been a feature of this round, where the wage rates have effectively had the CPD allowance pumped into those wage rates.
That's right, yes. The other changes are a one-off good faith payment, and that's prorated for part-timers, and it's a bit different depending on what employee group you're talking about.
Okay.
And that really covers the period back to the normal expiry date of the previous agreement. Also, there's with the subsequent increases, there's really parity with the other agreements, so they're occurring at similar times and similar amounts.
So it's going to seem very familiar.
That's right.
All agreements are required to have a service delivery partnership plan. So once we deal with the FFPPOOA, we have to deal with the SDPPWG, which is the working group for the service delivery partnership plan. There's a lot of commonality between those provisions, but there are also some unique points under each of them. What are the unique points for the mental health agreement?
Yeah, for the mental health agreement, you're right, most of the points are the same. There are a couple of unique ones, such as collaboration around the implementation of the government's 10-year mental health plan, for instance. And also the other point is there was a lot of talk, especially from the unions, about duplication of paperwork and that taking away from clinical time. So as part of that working party, there will be some focus on whether there can be some reduction in that documentation as well. Now, we know from the service delivery partnership plans that that's not compulsory for health services to adopt, but it's a body of work that they can draw upon if they wish to.
It's going to be interesting to see how much of an opportunity there is to remove that duplication. I mean, I think that's a really good point that unions make, that in terms of the impact on workload, to remove any avoidable duplication to the extent possible. It'd be interesting to see what role technology might play also in supporting those kind of work practices.
Yeah, I think intuitively it would have to have benefits, but we'll see through the process what can be realised out of that process.
There are also some other provisions that are going to seem quite familiar to people who are familiar with some of our other agreements, particularly with respect to occupational health and safety.
Yeah, a lot of these occupational health and safety provisions will be very familiar with people who have already implemented the nurses agreement, for instance, or the nurses and midwives agreement. So things like the occupational health and safety workplace violence clauses, there's a range of those, the industry OH&S working group, and also the occupational violence and aggression prevention and management clauses. They're all very similar to the nurses. So they're all in there as well. We're through the implementation process the unions will be trying to seek as much commonality about how they look for health services as possible. For instance, health services aren't going to have two occupational violence and aggression policies for different disciplines. They're going to have one. So we'll need to do that through the process as well.
It's interesting. I mean, and going back to that point about getting greater commonality, whether it's in industrial relations or things arising out of industrial relations, it makes sense in order to get better and more consistent outcomes to get as much commonality as possible, notwithstanding that each of the groups will have their own contribution to make to how those frameworks look.
That's right. And the application in different units may be different as well. So, for instance, a paediatric ward may be very different to an adult inpatient unit, for example.
There are also a range of other provisions that are consistent with other agreements, including the union matters clause, which has a range of features. Probably worth reminding people that one of the obligations is to ensure that electronic communications aren't hindered. There was no suggestion on the part of the unions that there was some sort of deliberate attempt to hinder those electronic communications, more to the point that sometimes unions will send mass communications and computer systems sometimes detect those incorrectly as spam. So it's really just having an eye to the fact that adding the union address to a safe senders list might be a useful way to combat that. The other sort of common provisions include the NES around the flexible work arrangements.
Yes.
And some other matters as well.
So things like superannuation, requiring superannuation payments on the long period of parental leave.
The long period of parental leave.
Yeah, so for the primary carer. Also amendments to the parental leave clause to take into account things like breastfeeding facilities. I know that the mental health agreement already had touched upon that subject. But just to expand it and make it absolutely clear, those sort of things, pre-adoption leave, permanent care orders, these sort of matters have been incorporated into the provisions, which will look very similar to people.
So these are provisions that are common across agreements within the common provisions part of this agreement. However, there's some parts that are within the common terms, but don't extend across agreements and are specific to the mental health agreement.
Yeah, so there's been the insertion of a comprehensive community workload management system into the new agreement. And look, for those people within mental health services, this won't be unfamiliar. It's been a topic in the last agreement, some health services have found it challenging. So really in this agreement, there's a process to follow to make sure that we get to where we want to get to with that clause.
So I'm mindful we haven't got up to the point yet of identifying key implementation issues arising from this particular agreement, but it sounds from that description we can reasonably anticipate that the workload management clause will be one of those.
I think so, yes, for sure.
What are the other sort of matters that are being introduced into the common part of that agreement?
So the other major clause in that section is the insertion of a community discipline mix provision. So this is really around setting a mark within community teams, where if the percentage of registered nurses drops below a certain level, then there's a series of things occur. And that includes a working party being established to identify whether that compromises the ability of the community health services the community teams to provide the services they need to.
So is that sort of inspired by service considerations or workload considerations or both?
It's probably a combination of both. We know that the community teams use a range of disciplines to deliver their service. So this is more about just making sure that if there is a change in that discipline mix, that there's no unintended consequences going to arise. And look, it may be that they're not deliberate it may be that just the workforce shortages, for instance, might be one of the driving forces. So this is just about putting in some safeguards so that the conversation can occur if that trigger happens.
So moving on to Section 2 with regards to the registered nurses and or RPNs and PENs, what are the key standout items under that section of the agreement?
So there's the insertion of a PEN for education support classification for enrolled nurses. And also there's some additional EFT for that. So there's one EFT for each of the clusters around the PN4 level. So that's a positive thing for health services.
So is that a new role or is that a new classification for an existing role?
No, it's a new role and a new classification. So these are specific if you want EN educators.
And there are some provisions with regards to HDUs?
Yeah, so there's some workload management arrangements for HDUs. That really looks like a ratio within HDUs. And there's some additional EFT being allocated to support that as well.
It's an interesting thing that there's a significant focus on staffing and workload. I think one of the interesting challenges for ourselves, but also the unions, is how do we measure what's effective and what's not? Mm. So that when we come to this discussion in another few years, that we have a better sense of where the strengths and weaknesses are.
It's very true, I think. I mean, what we have done is put in some safeguards around that allocation so that there can be a decision on the ground about allocation. So, for instance, if the rest of the ward is busy or clinically requires it, then that allocation can be adjusted. And really that relies on those people being on the ground making those best clinical decisions at the time.
It's an interesting thing when you think about the ability to ensure an appropriate safety net, which is what many of these clauses are directed at, and that's an important and a good thing. And matching that to the ability to respond to changing circumstances.
Exactly, yes.
So there are also some provisions in that section which really reflect the General Nurses Agreement.
Yes, there are. So a good example of that is the recognition of previous interstate and international service for nurses, which is duplicates the same provision in the General Nurses and Midwives Agreement.
And Section 2 of the agreement also contains some staffing provisions relevant to CAT teams, I understand.
Yeah, so there's an amendment to the hours of work clause, which requires employers to, with part-time employees, to have an 8-8-10 roster, essentially. So that's for bed-based services and also CAT teams.
Moving on to the section dealing with allied health professionals, a lot of the provisions in there seem to reflect the general allied health professionals agreement, but there are a couple of exceptions.
Yeah, so the mental health agreement has a higher level now for annual leave for health professionals, so they've got an additional 2.5 days. They've also got capacity to purchase another 2.5 days so that gets them up to that 5 weeks.
Now, that that change to annual leave has come at some cost. Some other provisions have been amended.
Yeah, so the removal of the conference day leave, seminar leave, the 2 days there, also an adjustment to the public holidays penalty rate as well, have been traded off for that.
It's interesting to see that conference seminar leave has been traded away. It's very much an essential component in the acute discussions, but it's interesting that that's been directed in somewhere else.
Yes.
For the mental health agreement.
That's right.
So it's interesting that we've got that those components that are completely on foot with the allied health agreement and those points of distinction.
And it's, I mean, the mental health is a little bit unique in that respect, in that for some of the community teams, they do have a health professional doing the same role as a nurse, so that's one of the considerations, I think, that led to this outcome.
And in terms of the section relevant to health and allied and managers and administrative workers, those sections of the agreement, starting with health and allied services, and any key changes that arise from there?
Yeah, so there's a reclassification of clerical workers. We know that they're already at clerical worker B, so those ward clerks, but also there's a process where those staff who have contact with patients and clients are also reclassified to clerical worker B. So this might be, you know, receptionists in community-based teams who have dealings with clients every day. They would also be reclassified. There's also a review process to see whether the current descriptors adequately match what those clerical workers do.
Okay, so one of the challenges, I guess, for everyone will be to make sure that process for review does occur as scheduled.
That's right, yes.
And there's also, you made reference before to the to peer workers and the insertion of a peer worker structure.
Yeah, so peer workers are something that's been used more commonly in the field. So given that they didn't really have a structure within the agreement, that's been inserted as well. And look, it looks very similar to the consumer consultant structure. Obviously, that was funded through one of the recent EBAs. This one's a little bit different, but it's very similar.
Okay. So in terms of the next steps for this particular agreement, aside from the fact that we're waiting for it to go through the commission process of review and approval, what's the next step for us?
So like the previous agreements, our focus now is on assisting the implementation. So to do that, we'll be running member forums and also doing an implementation guide as well. And like the other agreements where we had some key implementation issues that we continued to use a reference group to work through, we'll be doing that with the mental health agreement as well.
Okay, so the key message will be that we'll be applying the same process to this agreement as to the previous agreements, that is member forums to explain the changes, an implementation guide which will be developed in consultation with the unions and then available to members, and the identification of key implementation issues and the maintenance of the reference group to work through those implementation issues.
That's right. I mean, it's really important that we continue to evaluate some of these clauses, all of the clauses really that have gone into the agreement, so that we can make sure that we're well equipped to make improvements in the next round if needed.
Okay, well, I think I'm a bit more optimistic that we should be able to take the next agreement away from James Joyce territory and make it even more transparent and improve still. So thank you very much for joining me this afternoon, Tim.
Thanks, Stuart.
And thank you very much to Captain Beefheart and his magic band.